Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Jambase Podcast, a member of the Osiris Podcast Network. I'm Scott Bernstein, and co-hosting with me today is Jambase contributing writer Chad Bernstein. How's it going, Chad?
Good to see you, Scotty.
Excellent. For episode 52 of the Jambase Podcast, we'll hear Andy Kahn's musical mentors chat with Nels Klein of Wilco. Before we get to AK's chat with Nels, we'll start with the rundown of recent live music news. Up first is a recap of the many tour announcements that have come down in the past few weeks. One particularly interesting one came from Melvin Seals and JGB, who not only announced over two dozen 2020 dates spanning February through May, they also confirmed guitarist John Cadlesic has officially joined the band as a permanent member. Chad, you've long been a DSO fan and saw John K in Further and other projects over the years. Do you think this is a good fit?
Yeah, you know, I like the move. I've listened to some of the recent Melvin shows with John aboard as a special guest, and it sounds like they've revitalized each other reasonably well. You know, not that either of them needed revitalization, but both the JGB and John have had useful transition over the past 2 years, and I just can't think of a reason why it doesn't make sense. I mean, like most of us, I just love that music. And John's wheelhouse from his Dark Star Orchestra days was, you know, a lot of the stuff that Jerry was doing in the late 70s and into the 80s, and that obviously lines up really well with a lot of what Melvin and the JGB choose to focus on. So I'm really excited to hear what this band sounds like, especially 6 to 9 months from now when they've really dug in and been on the road together as an established lineup.
I would say that I just hope, I love the Golden Gate Wingmen. That's one of my favorite projects, certainly involving John. And I just hope it doesn't take away from that. I mean, Melvin and that band, they hit the road hard. There were hardly any days off. They announced their fall tour and it was like one day off per week. And that just blew my mind. So we'll see how it works out, but I definitely agree that it's a good fit. I think it helps that they have a couple of months under their belts. And like you said, let's see where they're at 6 to 9 months from us.
I agree, and also totally with you on Golden Gate Wingmen. Tough enough to schedule those four very busy guys, but a wonderful band that's really come to fruition. So Scott, another big tour announcement came from the Tedeschi Trucks Band. The TTB revealed that they will be joined by St. Paul and the Broken Bones for next summer's Wheels of Soul tour. TTB keyboardist Gabe Dixon will open each night with his trio and then pull double duty with the headliners. Going to be some busy shows for Mr. Dixon, I would say. The 2020 Wheels of Soul tour, a great summer tradition that's been in place a few years now with the Tedeschi Trucks Band. We'll begin after the band takes what's kind of a rare 3-month respite from touring in the spring, and is currently scheduled to run from a show in Derek and Susan's hometown of Jacksonville on June 26th of 2020 through two nights at Colorado's famed Red Rocks Amphitheater on July 31st and August 1st. The tour will hit over 20 cities in 5 weeks' time. So Wheels of Soul to come.
Yes, indeed.
We also recently found out about the return of Pearl Jam, the Rock and Roll Hall of Famers' first tour in 2 years. Feels like longer than that. Two years.
Sure does.
Will take place in Europe. Pearl Jam will mix headlining dates and festival appearances between late June and late July. And here's hoping we see some stateside action
Would certainly be down with that. And, you know, I think one of the reasons that it feels like it's been so long is because the tour they did in 2018 was just a handful of shows. So, I mean, it's been a while. So I think maybe since 2016, since they did like a real U.S. tour.
I was going to say, I don't know if we could call that a tour.
Yeah, I guess that's fair enough.
Back in 18. What else is cooking, Scotty?
There's King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard, who announced 10 North American dates between their quote-unquote marathon shows. And I say that because playing three-hour shows to us in the jam scene is no big deal. And those marathon shows will be at the Greek in Berkeley and at Red Rocks. Meanwhile, Alison Krauss will hit the road for 5 weeks, starting with an appearance at Merlefest in North Carolina in April and focusing on the eastern half of the U.S. through a June 4th show in Tupelo, Mississippi. We also heard from Tame Impala, who confirmed a massive arena tour of North America. The tour comes in support of the band's 2020 studio album, The Slow Rush, with dates on both coasts and many cities in between this summer, including their headlining debut at The Gorge. As for the jam scene, Billy Strings will play some of his biggest venues yet during an April tour, while ALO will follow their annual tour d'amour of the West Coast with a short East Coast run, scheduled for late March and early April. Chad, who are some of the other artists that will hit the road early next year?
Alabama Shakes frontwoman Brittany Howard will continue to focus on supporting her 2019 solo album Jamie well into 2020. What a great album. If you haven't heard it, you're missing out on something special. Howard announced March and April legs of a spring tour featuring her solo band. Additionally, Patti Smith, the great Patti Smith, confirmed a handful of U.S. tour dates with her band slated for early 2020. She detailed a run of West Coast shows and also a performance in Minneapolis. There was also news from the Guster camp as the band announced their first acoustic tour in 7 years. Guster will be joined by Strings and has tapped Connor Ratliff from the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater to run a comedy element at each show. That cross-country tour runs from February 27th through April 4th. Kamasi Washington detailed a month-long winter tour that spans February 14th to March 12th. Highly recommended. Talk added a spring tour to their already extensive early 2020 touring plans. And Humphreys McGee will focus on the Midwest as they continue to expand their Hindsight 2020 tour into April. As always, be sure to head to jambass.com for full details on these tours and many, many others. Scotty, sir, Phish recently finished their fall tour. Dare I ask if you had a chance to catch any shows?
Shocker. Yes, I did. I saw Nassau and Philly. As for Nassau, which was the Sunday night of Thanksgiving weekend, I really loved the set list selections. The Ghost opener was the best jam of the night, which was interesting to have that happen so early. But another winner of a jam was in Everything's Right, a song that continues to be a standout. And it was clear the band was having a blast. Really liked the cool transition into cities they did. A lot of people complained about having issues with venue staff. I had no such issues, I guess, thankfully for me. And talking about Everything's Right, I thought the Philly show, which was for SiriusXM subscribers at the Met on December 3rd, everything went right that night, certainly for me, and I think for the band as well. I really wasn't expecting anything special, but they quickly proved me wrong. They played Tweezer really early in the show and then reprised it a couple of times throughout, busted out a cover of ZZ Top's Jesus Just Left Chicago for the first time in 5 years, threw in really cool jams into Kill Devil Falls in 2001, two songs that aren't exactly known as jam vehicles. They also did a fun ass-handed Into Weekapah segment. And overall, I just, in my opinion, it's the best show of the tour. And for some reason, it's just not getting as much love as I thought it should from the Phish community. I think maybe the nature of the show and the fact that so few people got to attend it may be part of it. And I do hope one day that show gets its due. And overall for the tour, it was a bit schizophrenic, I would say. I think that's a fair descriptor of the tour. They did no repeats. There were also no 20-minute jams. They did make the improvisation count when they did, and there were 16 sets and 190 songs throughout. And some high moments and a few low moments, but the band really did seem like they were having a blast throughout the whole thing, and I certainly had a blast at the two shows I saw.
Good stuff. I mean, as long as there are long after Phish ever decides to hang it up, there'll be plenty of opinions and discussion to have.
Sure.
Obviously, we've got four more shows still to come, close out 19 here at the Garden in New York. But how do you think we're going to remember 2019 as a Phish year?
I think it's an important transition year. There's so much material that has been debuted. And not only from Trey's Ghost of the Forest project, but also all the songs that they played for the first time on Halloween last year when they donned the musical costume of Kazavat Voxt. All those songs really came into their own this year. I think using the phrase schizophrenic is fair to describe the whole year. But I think it's really a year that makes it clear that they're not done yet. They continue to add new material at a rapid rate. And I could be wrong, I don't know this for a fact, but I feel like that fall tour wasn't part of the plan coming into the year, but they were just having such a blast that they didn't want to go that whole time without a tour. I feel like the jamming was spot on. At times there wasn't much of it. I also feel the show that they ended the bulk of the summer tour with, the final night of Alpine, is a top 10 show in Phish history, and pretty cool that 36 years in, they're still playing shows that can be in the top 10.
Inarguable, as far as whatever your musical stripe or persuasion, love Phish, hate them, anywhere in between, any band that can still be doing that at this stage of careers is astounding, I think.
It really is. Chad, let's end the rundown with a recap of the festival lineups that have been announced recently. How about that Peach lineup?
Not too shabby, my friend. The 2020 Peach Festival, which returns to Montage Mountain in Scranton, Pennsylvania, July 2nd through the 5th of 2020, will feature Oysterhead, two sets of the String Cheese Incident, two sets from Joe Russo's Almost Dead, featuring Oteil Burbridge on bass, as well as performances from Umphrey's McGee, Moe, Pigeons Playing Ping Pong, Oteil and Friends, Tower of Power, Spafford, Goose, Twiddle, and dozens more. And additionally, the festival will host the first public performance by jam bass favorites The Slip since 2015, and has tapped Billy Strings as its artist at large. Over on the other coast, we have the 30th annual High Sierra Music Festival, which will be held July 2nd through the 5th in Quincy, California. High Sierra organizers are rolling out the lineup slowly, and as of this recording, have confirmed Joe Russo's Almost Dead, Spafford, The True Loves, and Lindsay Liu, with many others to be announced over the next few months. Heading to the middle of the country, Electric Forest 2020 will take place in Rothbury, Michigan, June 25th through 28th, featuring three incidents from the String Cheese Incident, as well as performances from Bass Nectar, the Disco Biscuits Flume, Big Gigantic, Keller Williams' Grateful Grass, Lotus, Black Pumas, the California Honey Drops, and many others. Electric Forest will also notably host a tribute to Talking Heads' Remain in Light in honor of the 40th anniversary of that landmark album, featuring Turquoise and special guests Jerry Harrison and Adrian Ballou. Turquoise, Harrison, and Ballou will perform the tribute at both the Peach Fest and Floyd Fest as well. Down in Gulf Shores, Alabama, the Hangout Music Festival will be held May 15th through the 17th, featuring headliners Red Hot Chili Peppers, Post Malone, Billie Eilish, and Marshmello. Meanwhile, Dark Star Orchestra will play six sets over the three nights of their Dark Star Jubilee Festival at Legend Valley in Thornville, Ohio, next Memorial Day weekend. Oteil and Friends, Galactic featuring Angelica Jelly Joseph, Zero, The Infamous String Dusters, Jorma Kaukonen, Keller Williams, and Marco Benevento are some of the other acts set to meet DSO at the Jubilee. Another band with its own festival, Pigeons Playing Ping Pong, who will play five sets over three nights at their annual Dome Fest. The event will take place at Marvin's Mountaintop in Masontown, West Virginia, between May 14th and 16th, with Spafford, Sunsquabby, Aqueous, Magic Beans, Le Special Litz, and CBDB aboard, among many other acts. Finally, Merlefest continues to roll out the list of performers who will play the 2020 installment of that long-running event in Wilkesboro, North Carolina. Willie Nelson and Family, Allison Krauss, John Prine, Billy Strings, Colin Hay, Jerry Douglas, Sam Bush, and Jim Lauderdale are just a few of the acts that'll perform at Merlefest next year. Last, real last this time, Delfest's initial lineup is out. Del McCurry and his clan will host the event over Memorial Day weekend 2020 in Cumberland, Maryland. In addition to sets from Del and the Traveling McCurries, Delfest will host Old Crow Medicine Show, St. Paul and the Broken Bones, Bela Fleck and the Flecktones, Punch Brothers, and more. Summer's already shaping up.
It really is, and I have a feeling it's only getting started. There'll be plenty of opportunities to go see live music, that's for sure. Well, that's it for the rundown. Stay tuned for Andy's Musical Mentors chat with Wilco guitarist Nels Klein. And don't forget to check out Osiris's After Midnight podcast for a deep dive into Phish's Big Cypress Festival.
I'm here with Nels Klein in St. Paul before Wilco's three-show run at the Palace Theater. They're the last shows of the tour before you guys go to Chicago for your annual Winterlude run in December. So Nels, how's the tour been going?
It's been going really well. We've had, I think, really strong performances by the Wilco band. The audiences have been, in some cases, almost alarmingly engaged.
That's cool.
Like rowdy and almost out of control, which is sort of simultaneously charming and alarming, you know. But
something you need to be aware of.
Yeah, and we played some really nice theaters, and we're keeping it together. You know, I'm a little at the end of a cold, but other than that,
surviving, thriving.
Yeah, I think we've all stayed mostly healthy, and that's kind of a challenge sometimes because the weather's been very mercurial.
Yeah, no doubt. And we're here, in St. Paul. At least it's holding out for now. You'll probably get some snow while you're here, though. I would imagine.
Yeah, well, I guess it's going to get cold at night. I kind of expected that.
Sure, sure. So you guys are touring on your new album, Ode to Joy.
We are.
How are the new songs shaping up as you're doing the shows?
I will paraphrase what Mr. Jeff Tweedy has said about them, because I agree wholeheartedly that they're surprisingly effective live and work very easily into our set dynamically, instrumentally, orchestrationally, however you want to think about it, mood-wise.
Okay.
And I don't know if we had that certainty going into the tours.
Why do you think that?
Well, because the record has a what I might term a rather unique sonic signature, in that it has most of the songs are based around Jeff playing this rubber bridge acoustic guitar that has virtually no sustain, and it's a very unique sound, and the drums are very, very prominent and virtually cymballess, and in some instances kind of like ritual pounding or marching or as I like to say, sort of like being flogged or something. And to have thought ahead of time that we were going to capture those sounds and moods and dynamics would have been unlikely. And so we started playing them and working on them live, and it's just really come together. And I think we're all really pleasantly surprised.
That's cool. That makes sense. There's definitely a vibe across the whole record, and I think that explains it.
And that's the way I think Jeff designs things, especially this record. I know he had an idea about how it could come out in that way, in a way where there's a consistent mood, because that would be probably a pretty one note.
Right.
But there is an aesthetic that
there
works through the whole thing.
I agree,
and a lot of it has to do with how he sings, because he doesn't even sing full voice on a lot of the material.
Right,
it's very, very dulcet, kind of
subdued, a little
subdued, and I think very vulnerable sounding. Mm-hmm. And then there are these throbbing drum and percussion parts that Glenn worked really hard on with Jeff to achieve a different sound, really, for the band.
It's a terrific record, and I'm looking forward to hearing those songs over the next few nights.
Yeah, we're playing most of the record. There's a couple of songs. Well, one of them we've played once live, a song called Citizens, and Empty Corner, the last song on the record, we played only a handful of times, just because we have a lot of other songs we want to play, and those are not super exciting live songs.
Gotcha.
Not that everything needs to be exciting, but
the way it translates to the live stage.
Yeah, and we just want to keep the energy at least somewhat up, so people.
It is a rock show. Yeah, it is a rock.
We like to rock
show,
out too, not just the audience.
I also want to mention you have a new record out called Spinning Creature for your project called Cup.
Oh yes.
I love the record.
Oh, thanks.
And I really was surprised when I listened to the first track, Every Moment. I saw you at Eau Claire's in 2017, and I was about...
You saw Cup at Eau Claire?
About as close as we are right now in this room. I was sitting on the ground. I was close enough to you, I could hear the clicks on your pedals. It was so cool, though. And that was, I remember you played that song, and so when I put the record on, and heard that song, and it took me right back to sitting in front of you at Eau Claire's. And I encourage everyone out there listening to check the record out. It's with your wife.
Yeah, Yuka.
Yuka Honda. Yeah. And the two of you did a really fantastic job. And I just wanted to mention
that. Wow, that's really amazing. I don't think anyone has ever both listened to and attended a Cup performance who isn't in New York. I don't know. It's like very unusual. So thank you.
Yeah. It was one of the highlights of the set of my Eau Claire's that week.
Nice.
It was just a thrill of a lifetime to get to, we were surrounded in the woods. It was a very small stage.
With the threat of rain.
Yeah, with the threat of rain and everything. And it was such a successful show and set. And I really enjoyed it. And I was thrilled that song was on, and the rest of the song.
Thank you. Well, yeah, every moment's kind of, we always start with it so far anyway. It's because it's kind of our invocation. Mm-hmm. And a piece of music that I came up with when I met and fell in love with Yuka. Okay. And so it meant there was going to be a big positive change in my life. And that's what that song is an outgrowth of.
Absolutely beautiful.
Thank you.
That's beautiful to hear. I mentioned at the top here, but we're talking musical mentors today, and so I want to go back to your beginning as in your childhood. Mm-hmm. So was the guitar your first instrument?
Technically, yeah, but I also, because they didn't have electric guitar in the elementary school orchestra, I played trumpet.
Okay.
Which I had no interest in playing.
So you were forced into trumpet. So how did you get a guitar?
I will preface all this by saying that I have an identical twin brother named Alex, and that Alex and I did everything together growing up, pretty much. So when I sometimes say we, it's not the royal we.
It's specific.
But it definitely, my development and my brother's musical development go hand in hand and mm-hmm. are in some ways inextricably linked.
Sure.
But I will say that both of our parents were school teachers in the Los Angeles City school system, and both taught at that point junior high school until they retired. But they had done other teaching assignments, and my mother had been in administration briefly downtown Los Angeles, but that was before we were born. And my father, knowing that I had this interest in playing guitar, bought an electric guitar from one of his students, which I still have.
You do still have it?
Yeah.
What kind of guitar was it?
It was a Melody, Japanese, one pickup, very, very small, half scale, I would say. It's not even three-quarter scale. And I think it cost $30 or something. And I didn't know anything about guitar. I didn't know anything about tuning a guitar.
What made you want to play it then?
Rock and roll.
Just rock. Yeah.
Specifically, the Byrds were maybe my first big inspiration. My brother was obsessed with the Rolling Stones. And he learned how to play drums playing along with Rolling Stones records on a drum set owned by a friend of ours who was a kind of amazing drummer already at age 10 or something.
Oh, wow.
His name is Pat Pyle, and he had a drum set. So we would go over to his house, and he was so generous. He and Alex would trade off playing along with Rolling Stones songs, and I picked up his uncle's electric bass that was there and just ran my fingers up and down it was going or whatever I was doing. Had a little Crown amp, and I think it was a Crucianelli bass, and that was it. I just, it felt like magic was in the air, you know. And then listening to the Birds as a kind of wannabe juvenile delinquent with my juvenile delinquent friends was kind of creating a special connection to the music. And I got the guitar and immediately started writing quote unquote original material, meaning ridiculously primitive songs with playing with my two fingers on my left hand, my thumb on my right, just going up and down the high E string with the open B ringing. And my brother and I formed a band with this guy, Pat, who played bass and not drums because he was just a really cool guy and just thought this would be fun. And our friend Steve, and we had a band called Homogenized Goo and played at our elementary school graduation, three original compositions.
So elementary school. Yeah. So that's, you're young, man.
Yeah, we were 12 years old then.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And my brother was always pretty darn good. I was not. So it was years before I even started using all the fingers on my left hand to play guitar.
Really?
Yeah.
So your brother and you are both musically talented, right? Was music?
I think
part
Alex
of your...
was musically talented.
Well,
I don't know if
now
I
you're
was...
selling yourself a little short. But
it took. I'm a late bloomer. Let's put it that way.
Fair enough. Yeah, but you both are musical. We'll say.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Does it run in your family? Or your parent? Were your parents musical at all?
They were musical as people who appreciated music, but I don't know of any musicians in the family tree.
Really?
No, but
starts with
YouTube. Apparently, yeah. But my parents were, and I think this is something I've heard about maybe their generation, certain types of people of their generation. They were very musically inclined, but also artistically inclined, and could both of them carry a tune. My mother had been a sort of noticed singer in her church in South Dakota when she was a girl and aspired to sing until she was entered in a contest and she didn't want to compete singing. It ruined it for her. But she had a beautiful voice and loved opera, but she wasn't an opera type singer, but she liked opera probably the same way I like fast guitar sometimes. But anyway, you know, those listen to those chops. But no, she liked the music, but she really loved easy listening type singers like Perry Como and Andy Williams and Bing Crosby. Yeah, crooners. And
so were you listening to that in the house? Like, was she playing a lot in the house?
Yeah,
was
my
music
father played,
prevalent?
My father, who also could carry a tune and sometimes did his version of songs singing in funny voices when he was feeling whimsical. He was really into Broadway musicals, and my folks both loved Broadway musicals and would go to eventually go to New York on regular visits to see whatever was good that year. And so I heard all of that stuff, especially on weekends after watching Sherry Lewis or something. My dad would play the stereo on a Saturday before he was going to go out and do yard work or something.
Sure.
And so he'd hear Funny Girl or No No Nanette or Fiddler on the Roof. And we went to go see these things with our parents. And growing up, my brother and I really, I think probably saw more plays and musicals than movies in movie theaters, that is.
I'm sure that had some sort of influence on
it. Did. I mean, I think theater is absolutely magical, and certainly live performance of music was related to this, and the excitement was very similar as a young person. And so with the advent of rock and roll, as opposed to most of my friends' stories, my brother and I didn't have to rebel to play music or to aspire to play music. And we were really encouraged by my folks. And what I wanted to say also about my folks is that, and I started to, is that they also could draw freehand anything.
Okay.
They could, and they were obviously hyper literate because they were teaching English and history.
Mm-hmm.
My mother taught speech, which is, I guess now you would call debate or something.
Right.
And my father had taught math at some point, science, drama. And my father really wanted to be, I think, a dramatic actor or a comedic actor, but on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And he never did that, but And my mother, I think, when they realized they had sons who had an interest in art, because we were also interested in visual art, were very happy. Mm-hmm. And so they encouraged us and possibly spoiled us in the sense that they made us feel special, I think.
So you mentioned initially you were just playing using a few fingers on your left hand and your thumb. did you eventually take lessons?
I tried. This was, you know, by 1972, maybe, I was in high school. Mm-hmm. I heard John Coltrane in 71 on a recording, and then also progressive rock around the same time. And I thought, oh man, you know, I've got to figure some things out. You know, I'm going to have to actually really learn how to play, because I'm not just going to play blues, which is what I was into, is blues rock. Mm-hmm. Jimi Hendrix was my first inspiration to play guitar for real. Mm-hmm. And I've told this story, but I'll tell it briefly, as briefly as I can, which is that one Saturday afternoon on the top 30 radio station, which in those days was just one list, all styles represented. Sure. And before the advent of underground FM in California, Southern California, we heard Manic Depression, which the DJ played instead of the single, which I reflected upon later, which was Purple Haze. I don't know why he played this, but we had seen this album cover and hadn't bought it yet. We used to buy a record every 2 weeks with our allowance. We'd each get a record. And sometimes the record would not be that great because there was no way to hear anything on the record other than the one single, or it just looked cool and we'd buy it. So we were a little cautious, having been burned with kind of uninspiring records, even though they looked like maybe one of the coolest records ever, already experienced, I mean. So when that song came on KHJ that Saturday afternoon, as we were sitting around the Garrard Hi-Fi, we knew right away it was that record. We could tell that it was a trio. We could tell that it was psychedelic and exciting. And we could tell it was like a black guy singing something about his voice. And we were literally freaking out. And we were jumping up and down, you know, saying, this is that Jimi Hendrix record. Yeah, it has to be.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And then when he does that step up where he's playing and singing with his guitar and then goes into the guitar solo, that was it. That was it. Yeah. I've never been the same.
Really?
And I just knew right then that, I mean, I already had the idea in my head, but it was cemented in the moment that I was just going to play music for the rest of my life.
Well, I think I'm going to turn myself off and I'm going down. Really ain't no use for me hanging around. You're kind of sweet. Music, sweet music. I wish I could caress in a kiss. Manic depression is a frustrating mess. Wow.
So lessons didn't really take?
Oh, so after hearing John Coltrane and Miles Davis and Weather Report and Yes and King Crimson, I thought I have to study. So I went to the neighborhood music store where my brother was starting to take drum lessons, or I guess he had already been taking drum lessons, and took guitar lessons with a guy who taught four instruments. And without going into any detail, because what I wanted to learn from him was sight reading and what I called jazz chords. And this guy pretty much psychologically destroyed me for decades to come.
Really?
Yeah. And I won't go into the details,
sure.
but anyway, he moved away after a few months, sparing me further damage. And then I took a few lessons with a guy named Bruce, who had lived in an apartment behind the music store. This is all in West Los Angeles. And then he almost killed me in a car accident. And then moved away. But he did teach me a diatonic scale in chords, which was the biggest aha experience of my life at that point, because then I started realizing how music is put together. Because I was not learning from the first teacher any theory at all. It was all going to be this kind of weird rote memory experience. And so without theory, it seems like a code you can't crack. So long story short, no, I never studied guitar. I never learned technique on the guitar. And I taught myself how to use all my fingers after looking at pictures of Steve Howe and his hand position, and also classical guitarists like Julian Bream and Andre Segovia.
Okay.
And I was listening a lot to Ralph Towner by this time, and you know, and Robert Fripp too, and just going to see these guys play. And so that was it. We were already writing original music and playing instrumental music in high school, in a band that played probably twice a year because it wasn't music anyone wanted to hear. All that, it wasn't, you know, going to be popular or sociable. So eventually I was told that it was too late for me to be a music major because I had started my studies too late. And I got into a fancy college as a in Los Angeles as a philosophy major.
Okay.
And although it disappointed my academic advisor and philosophy instructor, head of the philosophy department, that I eventually left to play music, it was kind of fortuitous that he had been a jazz bass player in college, and that's how he put himself through college in Florida, was playing bass. So he totally got it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I left when I realized this is absurd. I'm just, all I want to do is play music, you know? And I started over with theory. I tried in high school, didn't realize I was getting horrendous instruction in high school. We didn't have a textbook. We were doing figured bass and broke harmony. We were doing figured bass from the melody down instead of the bass line up. And so I started over at a community college, Santa Monica College. And here comes the mentor part. I had a teacher there. This was a big come down for somebody who had a high grade point average and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. If you looked at it on the surface, because this was a community college where people who couldn't get into college went.
Yeah.
And as opposed to being something like $4,000 a semester, it was $15 a semester. And the head of the music department was my Baroque Harmony teacher. I decided to start over, is what I should say. And he turned out to be miraculous. This man named Rule Beasley, still alive. Rule, R-U-L-E, is his actual first name.
Okay.
And he was from Texas. He had come out of North Texas State. He's a bassoonist and a composer. His compositions were super modernist.
Okay.
And he was just crystal clear teacher. And I also took musicianship, so I got ear training.
Okay.
Tried to study a little piano, but we didn't have a piano at my parents' house, so that didn't go as well as it might have.
Mm-hmm.
But I started to excel at least theory, and I started to understand how music is put together and apply that to playing guitar.
And you said Rule's still alive?
Yeah, he's at least he was last year,
because
his son, John Beasley, is a very well-known jazz pianist in Los Angeles, and played with Miles Davis in his last iteration, I think, and it does a lot of fusion kind of stuff too.
Have you two played together?
Only when he was in high school and I was in college.
Oh wow!
He was allowed to play in the Santa Monica College jazz band, and he was already amazing as a high school student. He sounded kind of like young McCoy Tyner, and Herbie Hancock was his idol, I think. And so I ran into him in Berlin when I was playing at the jazz festival last year with doing Lovers. And he was there with the Monkestra, where he does big band, kind of large ensemble versions of Thelonious Monk songs, and told me that Rule's 88, or maybe if he's still alive, he's 89 now, and rides a bike every day, and really amazing. And he's thanked on my first record, under my own name called Angelica, and as are John Carter and Bobby Bradford, who are also mentors of a different stripe, because they weren't technically my teachers, although they were both music teachers in Southern California. And Bobby Bradford had played trumpet. He plays cornet now, but maybe he was playing cornet then, I'm not sure, in Texas with Ornette Coleman before Don Cherry. Then he went into the Army, Bobby, and only went back to playing with Ornette sporadically after that, and is on some of the science fiction sessions. And then John Carter is his musical partner in a quartet called the New Art Jazz Ensemble, played woodwinds and eventually focused on clarinet. I ended up playing with both these men later in life when I started playing with the Charlie Hayden's Liberation Music Orchestra West Coast in the 80s, and I was playing nylon string guitar. Right. But John and Bobby were representatives of the jazz avant-garde in Southern California, and were not only gentlemen and musicians of the highest caliber and artists of the highest caliber, they're also people that would answer questions or be supportive of you. And as such, John and Bobby are very, very important to the development of not just myself as a musician, but so many of my friends. Really? Yeah. Bobby's still alive. He's well into his 80s. John passed away in 91, maybe. Okay. Yeah. And they were just amazing, amazing men.
Can you give me an example of like something that you... Yeah, I was going to do that too. We're turning on the light.
Yeah, if I can figure out where it is.
Is it down here, maybe?
No. We're in a hotel, people. Ah, beautiful. Now I can see you.
Put a little light on the subject.
Yeah. So what were you going to ask?
I was going to ask, can you specify something in particular that you can think of that they taught you, that you still rely on to this day as it informs you as a musician?
Well, I think in this case, it was more that they had an openness to just having us around. And we used to go hear them at a place called Rudolph's Fine Arts Center sometimes on Sunday afternoons, regular concerts. Bobby had a storefront place that he would have jam sessions during the day in Pasadena. He called the Little Bighorn. And you just felt accepted, right, by them. You weren't being hazed or you weren't being looked down upon. So just feeling encouraged by people of that caliber was really, really massive. And then later, when I started playing in Bobby's group, he was just very, very open to letting me do my thing, because I was still a terrible reader. When I first met him, I was 18, and we played in my philosophy professor's house, duo. And he started writing out a line, and I had this look on my face, and he said, "Let me guess, you don't read." And I said, no, I don't. I'm sorry. For years, if you put music in front of me, I would, because of this prior experience with this so-called teacher, I would have a panic attack. I would like seriously break out in a cold sweat, and my pulse would race.
Yeah.
You know, it was bad. I wasn't very
truly
courageous.
Scarred, but truly scarred.
But you know what? It's kind of
PTSD from it.
It's kind of wimpy, though. I mean, I really should have just been more militant and said, "I can get past this." To hell with that. It's also really hard to read on the guitar, by the way.
And you were young and impressionable. You know,
well,
right?
Until I had the Rule Beasley, I thought that music was a code I would never crack. I really thought that it was me. So when I played with Bobby, then he said, "You have great facility. You should learn to read music." And pretty much the same thing Ralph Towner said to me when I met Ralph Towner in maybe 1974 or 75. And I was so inspired by him. And he just said, here's what you need to do. You need to find a teacher and you need to learn how to read music. And I never did either one after that, really. I kind of taught myself to read music a little bit, and I can write it. But
you're not
I'm terrible. No, I don't have the same meltdown that I used to have. It's been a few years. It took decades to get over that, though, which is kind of bizarre. And I want to mention the most important musical mentor of my life before we go any further. I met a man in, I'm thinking it was 1977, named Eric Von Essen. I'm not sure what the year. It was also around the same time I met Vinnie Golia. Vinnie Golia is a woodwind player, composer, with whom I played on and off. I still do once in a blue moon. Since those days, my brother played with him for about 25 years, I think. And he was somebody who had started as a painter and was successful in New York, and then picked up saxophone and left New York and ended up in Southern California, and had been friends with Anthony Braxton and Chick Corea and Dave Holland and all these people we idolized. And we used to hang out almost every day. And improvise and whatever. But and so he was very, very important also. We were all sort of developing our thing at the same time, even though he's 10 years older. Mm-hmm. He had picked up saxophone in his 20s. So there's a really good example of somebody who can really do something and not have to be a five-year-old prodigy, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like
yeah.
Joe Bison, Saccharine Trust. He didn't even pick up guitar till he was in his 20s, you know? So it can happen.
Suppose it gives me hope.
I tell people it's never too late, and I'm sure I'm right about this. But anyway, Eric Von Essen was discovered by my brother's friend, Lee Kaplan. Lee was going to UCLA. We used to play music with Lee, but he was, I think he was majoring in some arcane subject like Egyptology or something. But he was in the practice rooms and heard this guy playing piano, and he was playing Song of the Wind by Chick Corea, one of our favorites, and was just astonished that anyone could play this, you know? And so he went in, because he was this kind of guy, he introduced himself and said, "You need to meet my friends, Nelson Alex." And eventually I did, and Eric was playing guitar and piano and tabla at this point. His mother taught at UCLA and taught Indian classical dance. He was half Indian, half East Indian, of course, half Swedish. His father's a Swedish cancer researcher of note, apparently. I never met his father, but his mother lived in West Los Angeles, and they had just moved up from La Jolla, California. And so I got together with Eric. And the first time we played, and I think it was with my brother and somebody else, he was playing electric guitar, but then he decided he wanted to play acoustic bass and started taking lessons and playing in the UCLA student orchestra. And he got good really fast. And so he and I started playing duets together, improvised, and we started writing. And Eric became this incredibly prolific composer and writing music in the sort of influenced by some of our favorite stuff at the time, which would have been the group Oregon, Ralph Towner's compositions, Keith Jarrett, mm-hmm. and Wayne Shorter, mm-hmm. people like that. And so, and Eric was one of those people for whom music was so natural that it seemed easy, really. It was just, he understood everything about it, and really that's all his life was. Yeah. He died in 1997. He had some substance abuse issues.
Sure.
He was an alienated man, but he was a genius. He was a musical mm-hmm. genius. And so when I started playing with Eric, and he would write pieces of music, he would show me exact voicings that he wanted with the chord symbol rather than write it all vertically in chords, and I would memorize these things. And this was how I learned a lot of cool chords.
Sure.
And it's also how I learned how to solo over these chords, because I would just ask him. If I didn't figure it out myself, if I had questions, uh-huh. I could just say, "Eric, what are you hearing over this B flat 7 plus 5 chord?" And he would say, I would say, "This should the seventh move?" Or does I ask him a question, but he said, like, "Oh, you can use both sevenths. Listen to, you know," he'd say, like, "Listen to whatever, some Miles tune,"
right.
And listen to what happens when Miles plays over blah 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 blah. And ultimately, he became my
educational.
He was my absolute biggest musical teacher. I mean, I learned more about music from just playing with him than I learned anywhere else.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and we played together. We eventually put a group together called Quartet Music with my twin brother, mm-hmm. Alex, and a violinist named Jeff Gauthier. And I played all acoustic guitars. I always played acoustic with Eric.
I was going to ask, were you mostly playing acoustic guitar?
I was playing 12-string, steel string, and nylon string. I don't play nylon string with classical technique, but I love the sound, so I still do it, you know. And so we formed this quartet called Quartet Music, and that lasted for about 11 years. We made 4 recordings and basically just withered because we couldn't get it. You know, we booked our own gigs, basically, you know. So it was hard. And then Eric decided he wanted to only study real, like what we call jazz in the traditional sense, and the American Songbook. And he, in very short amount of time, in spite of his long hair, became a first call jazz bass player in Los Angeles.
Wow.
And started playing with really heavy people and stopped writing music. Oh, okay. And for a while, mm-hmm. when he went back to composing, his style was definitely not so East-West fusion or impressionist in the manner of Ralph Towner's music or whatever. It was a little, I would say that the influence of Wayne Shorter as a composer was maybe his greatest influence ultimately. And the subtlety and the conciseness of those kinds of compositions, mm-hmm. I think he was capturing in his later work. And then he ended up teaching in Sweden and passing away in his sleep. At a high school, Swedish high school.
Very tragic.
But he was my biggest, most important mentor.
It sure sounds like he left you with a lot of new tools.
Absolutely. I mean, he knew, well, he eventually picked up chromatic harmonica. He sounded like Toots Thielemans in a year. Oh, wow. You know, he was just, and so there was something daunting about Eric, mm-hmm. which can be inspiring. Yeah. You know, go over to Eric's house, and he'd be living with his mother in the back house or something, because I mean, Eric and making money didn't quite go together for a while. And so of an afternoon, he'd be doing a takedown at the piano of a Mahler symphony, because he was really, really into Mahler for a while. And that was his idea of a fun time.
Wow. I wanted to ask you too about, so you know, your career is eclectic. You do jazz, punk, improvisational. You've obviously been in Wilco for a while.
15 years.
Is there somebody that you looked up to as you were sort of mapping out a life as a professional musician that you looked to emulate or at least saw as...
That's an interesting question.
Somebody that is doing what you're doing now?
You know, no, not really, because there were so many people, mm-hmm. and I didn't have a plan. I've never had a plan. I have no business sense.
Yeah, I picked that up, though, just from what you've told me so far today, is that like you sort of fell into a lot of this stuff.
I
right?
worked in a record store called Rhino Records from 76 to maybe 86, mm-hmm. with a little time off there managing the warehouse of an import record distributor, which was a nightmare. Well, just because the guy, the psycho-alcoholic boss. But anyway.
Even worse.
And so I was constantly meeting musicians at the record store.
Yeah.
And then later I worked in our my friend Lee's art bookstore for 8 years. And I worked retail jobs, these cool jobs, but retail jobs for about 18 years. And attempts to make a living not, you know, away from the day job, mm-hmm. failed. I tried a couple of times and I just couldn't make any money. So, I have no hustle. And also, to be honest, I mean, everyone thinks I know more than I know. So I'm not a particularly adroit jobber type musician. Mm-hmm. And I have versatility, but I can't really be efficiently generic. And as I've said, my reading's pretty damn bad. I feel now a little bit lucky in that I didn't get drawn into a jobber type of musical environment, not only because it wasn't interesting to me. I didn't have a super attitude about it, like I'm an artist or something, but I had my own musical ideas and was writing music. And as such, having not done that work or tried to go into the studios or something, I ended up loving music mm-hmm. every year and not ever getting a kind of jaundiced attitude. Mm-hmm. Yeah. As I've seen others experience.
Sure.
So, you know, my good friend Stuart Liebig, amazing bass player and composer in Los Angeles, with whom I played starting in the Santa Monica College Jazz Ensemble and then in the rock, kind of funk rock band called Block, and then lots of other stuff. Mm-hmm. Stuart had a joke, because we used to actually play together to work up this funk rock music at the Musicians Union in Hollywood. And he overheard these two guys in the parking lot, I guess, or somewhere, or maybe it was in the office, the head office there, the local 47. His friend said, hey, man, you know, doing much playing? And he said, yeah, I got eight holes in or nine holes in yesterday. You know, like that's the kind of thing that we avoided.
Yeah. Makes sense. The other thing I wanted to ask too is, so with your experience, have you served as a mentor for anyone?
Oh, I don't think so. No. I mean, I meet people that like what I do, but I don't, that's not really being a mentor.
Sure.
Relating to your previous question, there is somebody that comes to mind who wasn't a musician, who had an impact on me that might have been profoundly negative because it has nothing to do with making money in the real world. But my friend David Hirschman, that I went to junior high school and high school with, his father, Jack Hirschman, at one point the poet laureate of San Francisco years later, was a complete bohemian, former teacher of literature at UCLA, but who got fired for giving all the male students A's so they'd have higher grade point averages and not get drafted and go to Vietnam. And he was a known eccentric, wild bohemian poet.
Sounds cool,
and yeah. So I really looked up to him, even though his poetry was completely impenetrable, and I used to write poetry every day and I'd aspired to be a poet. So I think that even being in proximity to somebody who was that uncompromising in life and who was naturally that eccentric made a deep impression on me and just confirmed my earliest suspicions that the artistic life was the life for me, you know?
Definitely.
Because poetry and music go hand in hand anyway.
Of course.
And this is the beauty of playing Jeff Tweedy songs, you know?
No doubt.
You know, among other things that are good about it. But yeah. But anyway, so no, I don't think I've been a mentor. I'm reluctant to do workshops. I've done them. I did have somebody recently walk up to me and tell me that he had attended a talk I did at the New School years ago in Manhattan.
Yeah, New York.
And that he had been ready to give up music. He had been ready to, it sounded like he was almost suicidal actually.
Wow.
And that whatever I said about the crooked way that I came up rescued his whole psyche that year. And he's still playing and has never forgotten it. So that was really great because I also was told right after that New School talk that people were really bummed out because I hadn't played enough guitar.
Oh.
I'd done too much talking, but I think I only had an hour, but I don't know.
You can't please everyone.
I'm a talker too, but.
Well, I'm glad to have you here talking.
Okay. This is so great. Anyway, I was a mentor to somebody like
you
know.
What about though, you know, Wilco tends to have opening acts that are up and coming groups often. Do you find yourself ever just when you're chatting with them, sharing advice from your years of experience? And
well, it's usually just guitar geekdom.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Yeah. For example, just on this tour, we had Deep Sea Diver out with us. And I had already, they'd opened for us before, and I had befriended Jessica Dobson, who I see as, you know, a very talented individual. Mm-hmm. And so we geek out. And also I have... I've had for years and years a strong desire to see more women playing guitar and really going for it and creating this new kind of feeling where you don't have to get asked what's it like to be a woman in rock anymore, where it's actually as everybody together playing, but we need more and more encouragement of that kind of endeavor in order to break down that sort of mindset, because here I am singling her out as a woman playing guitar, right. But that we're still there.
Yeah, I've got two daughters and I'm always trying to find role models mm-hmm. for them, you know, and the more the merrier.
Okay, well, here's who I suggest, except that their music can be extremely intense.
That's all good.
Mary Halverson.
Yes,
and Ava Mendoza.
Okay.
And Ava, I don't think I was a mentor to her, but I was, I think, helpful when I met her many years ago. She was maybe 17.
Oh, wow.
Maybe 18 years old and living in Irvine, California, and came to a gig I was doing with Scott Amendola Band in Hollywood. and walked up to me, and you know, this absolutely striking Latina individual, and said, "Can I ask you a question?" And I said, "Sure." And she said, "I'm really interested in improvised guitar, and I've been listening to a lot of Derek Bailey. Could we talk sometime? I have some questions." And I said, "Call me tomorrow."
Very cool.
And we got together and played a little bit back then. And I don't do that very often, because not only am I kind of reluctant to just like jam, we have to get together with people and say like, "Hey, let's go. What song you want to play?" I don't really, I feel comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. But I'm kind of busy. So I just, yeah, you know, I like to have home time, mm-hmm, and not be playing every day all the time.
Yeah.
As much as I love to play, because I really do.
Obviously.
And so we're still friends and still play together once in a while. Yeah. Ava, and she's, you know, moved to New York years ago, which is a perfect, mm-hmm, thing. Perfect place for her, I would think. And after studying with Fred Frith and various individuals at Mills College, which I think was a really good move for her. And I know that Fred, who's incredibly inspirational to me, has been quite a mentor to probably hundreds of musicians in his time, if not thousands. So it's much easier for me to talk about people who inspire me than whether or not I've inspired anybody else.
Well, I'm sure you have, and I'm sure you will continue to. And I think that gets us to a good point to wrap up. Thanks.
Hey, thank you so much.
So much.
I've never been asked these kinds of questions about mentors or about these aspects of my background. And I guess in closing, I'd like to say that as someone who enjoys collaboration,
certainly, yeah,
musically, that I always am learning, and that everybody is a potential mentor, and, mm-hmm, and I am paying attention. So, I just feel like I have the luckiest life anybody could have, because I'm constantly stimulated and inspired and intrigued by the different voices and approaches that my colleagues, or however you want to look at them, my comrades, possess and essay in their work. And you just couldn't ask for a better life.
All the cool and amazing sounds you make. Indeed. Well, thanks, Nils.
Thank you so much.
That's it for episode 52 of the Jambase podcast. Jambase is pleased to be a media partner of the Osiris Podcast Network. Thanks to Nels for speaking with us, to Jake Alexander for producing this episode, and of course, thanks to you for listening. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the podcast provider of your choice. Also, be sure to hit us up with any comments by emailing podcast@jambase.com. And as always, go see live.